The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy. I'm the Director of Author Events, and it is my pleasure to welcome Ann Perry. All her life, she wanted to be a storyteller. With more than 20 million books in print and three concurrent series, including the Christmas books and the Victorian mysteries featuring detectives Thomas Pitt and William Monk, Miss Perry's passion has clearly become our pleasure. Tonight, she joins us to discuss her 25th Pitt novel, Buckingham Palace Gardens. Reviewing for the New York Times, Marilyn Stasio writes, "In this intricately plotted novel, unlike so many detective series gliding on cruise control, this mature work provides a fine introduction to Perry's alluring world of Victorian crime and intrigue. Ever the master of her milieu, Perry delivers sumptuous descriptions of life among the gentry when England still basked in its imperial glory." Please welcome Ann Perry.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. What a lovely lot of you there are. I do appreciate this. I would rather talk to you than read at you, but just I'd like to give you the very first page so that you have some idea of what it's going to be like. I've got an excellent American agent as well as, of course, a primary agent in London, but my American agent's advice, among other things, is that if you want to make a really good story, get your characters and put them in a situation that's the worst you can possibly think of, write a chapter or two, and then stop off and make it even worse. So I will start off with a very bad situation for poor Pitt. I'm also reaching the point where my arms are only just long enough so that I can see what I'm doing. "She was apparently found in the linen cupboard, poor creature," Narraway replied, his lean face dour, his eyes so dark they seemed black in the interior shadow of the hansom cab. Then before Pitt could say anything further, he corrected himself. "One of the linen cupboards in Buckingham Palace. It was a particularly brutal murder." The vehicle jerked forward, throwing Pitt back in the seat. "A prostitute?" he said incredulously. Narraway was silent for a moment. The horse's hooves clattered loudly, the carriage wheels rattling over the cobbles dangerously close to the pavement edge. "Surely that's a bad joke," he said at last as they swung around the corner into the mall and picked up speed again. "Very bad," Narraway agreed. "At least I hope so. But I fear it's perfectly serious. However, if Mr. Cahoon Dunkeld proves to be wasting our time exercising his sense of humour, I shall take great joy in personally putting him in jail, preferably one of our less pleasant ones." "It has to be a joke," Pitt said, shivering at the thought. "There couldn't be a murder at the palace. How could a prostitute get in there, anyway?" "Through the door, exactly as we shall, Pitt," Narraway answered. "Don't be naive, and she was probably more welcome than we shall be." Naturally, they are not very welcome. Her Majesty, fortunately, is not in residence. She is in Osborne and the Isle of Wight. This is 1895, so it's only 6 years before her death, so she's an old lady, and not of the very best temper, and has been in mourning for some very considerable time. However, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, waiting to ascend the throne impatiently, with rather a loose lifestyle, enjoying himself a great deal, not always with the Princess of Wales, Princess Alexandra, who became Queen Alexandra, and was quite seriously deaf. He has got a plan that is going to impress even Mama, who is not easily impressed. He is planning to build a railway between Cape Town and Cairo, which goes from the Cape of Good Hope to up to the Mediterranean, which is about twice as far as from here to San Francisco. So you can imagine it is an enormous undertaking, but it would unite the whole of Africa, the entire continent. And in that particular time, you could go from Cape Town to Cairo, and only once have to step off British soil, which is an extraordinary situation. But if you look at the map of the world in the 1890s, you see that an enormous amount of it was red. Not that we have any business there, but we were there. So he had this wonderful plan. So he has four gentlemen who all have particular talents, abilities, skills, influence, power, and money that would bring this to pass. And, of course, their lady wives, because it is intended to look as if it's simply a week or so's house party. But it is there for a very serious purpose. But as you may already have guessed, these gentlemen already know each other, sometimes very well. Their wives know each other and know the husbands definitely very well, some of them. And there are loves and hates and rivalries and an old death, which is highly questionable, crocodiles, all kinds of interesting things in Africa, and emotions so intense that they are going to boil over, which they do under the pressure of investigation when this unfortunate woman is found in the linen cupboard. After they've had an evening of considerable celebration, the ladies, of course, retire early to bed. They're wise enough not to know publicly what they know privately. What you can always behave with great dignity and pretend you don't know, as long as you're not actually forced to look. So they retired to bed early. The gentleman had a little bit of a party and then retired. And in the morning, one of them was walking along the passageway, and he noticed that the linen cupboard door was open, and he went to close it, and he smelled a very funny smell, and he opened it wider and saw what you will see when you read this. Then, of course, Pitt is called in. Now, he belongs to Special Branch now, not the police anymore, because this is a matter of national security. Of course it is. It would be very nice to think that one of the servants did it, but it's definitely, I mean, apart from the fact that you're not allowed to have butler did it. There are three. Well, you know you're not. There are three great rules to detective story writing. The butler did not do it. You are not allowed to have any identical twins, and you're not allowed to have any Chinamen. I don't know why there are no Chinamen. The identical twins is obvious enough. It's kind of cheating. I saw him. No, you didn't. It was my identical twin. Rubbish. But the butler did not do it, nor did any of the other servants. It was one of the guests, or one of their wives. And Pitt has to tidy this up quickly before Her Majesty returns, quietly, discreetly, and sufficiently believably that it will be accepted, and the answer must be one that they can live with, which is a pretty tall order when he's by himself, especially an answer that they can live with. Because it gets worse and worse and worse, because the more he discovers, the more the worst possible answer seems as if it could be the one. That is, His Royal Highness might have done it. Then what does Pitt do? It is just conceivable that there was such a disaster and it was nicely covered up. So I'm not going to tell you who did it. Of course I'm not going to. You'll know in the last page who did it, but... And how Pitt reacts. But it's a heck of a test for him. Because the standards of behaviour when you are in an enclosed space, you know that the police are going to do the very best that they can. Special Branch in this case is not really the police, it's sort of one of the secret services. They're going to have to sort it out. And a lot of old loves and hates are exposed in the very, very glamorous situation of being a house guest at Buckingham Palace. I mean, if you're not going to get your tiara out for that sort of a dinner, when are you going to get it out? The clothes are to die for, and I had such fun describing them. But the atmosphere is so tense. You know, people practically crack their glasses when they pick them up. And there's a grand passional love affair. There's an old hatred. There's tremendous jealousy. All sorts of secrets surface. And we know that Her Majesty is going to return on a specific date, and it must be sorted by then. Pitt has no help of his ordinary outside colleagues, but what he does do is he needs a downstairs view, because everybody knows that he is there to investigate. He needs somebody that is practically invisible. So he gets his own little maid, Gracie, to pose as a palace servant. Nobody knows except the butler who she is, and she finds it rather difficult because she's quite a good servant, but she's not trained up to palace standards. I mean, why would she be? She works for Charlotte, and she's treated not quite as an equal, but jolly close to in Pitt's household. She can be cheeky, and she can express opinions, and she's her own boss. In the palace, she is very certainly not. And she has a bit of a tough time, and they bully her a bit, because who is this jumped-up little piece that thinks she can walk in here and take over a job? And she learns quite a few things, because as a servant she is almost invisible. A servant is expected to go into people's bedrooms and tidy things up, and maybe open closet doors and look at things. She's expected to tidy up the dressing table and look at things. She notices a great deal, and she's very observant. People don't care what they say in front of servants, because it's like speaking in front of the furniture. It doesn't matter. So she learns quite a lot, and this is her glorious swan song, because she's going to marry Telman in the next book, because it really is time. Excuse me. And I'm very happy to say that I've got the next book planned. I'll tell you a little bit about it. Since this one was all a tight, closed space and a short time and a restricted cast, the next one's going to be spread all over the place, just to have a change. Pitt witnesses a murder in London, and he and his colleague chase off after the supposed culprit, and they go all the way to France. I don't know if anybody here has been to a seaside town called Saint-Malo in France. It's very beautiful. It's just beyond Mont-Saint-Michel. And like that, it is a magnificent medieval... Well, it was a medieval fortress town, and unfortunately in World War II it got bombed to smithereens, but they rebuilt it exactly as it would have been. So it is an unweathered medieval fortress town with walls that are 70, 80 feet high, and I don't know how many feet thick, but it's quite a journey to go in through the big entrance. And the streets are narrow and cobbled, and the buildings are very tall, and it's extremely picturesque. And there are sort of rocks out in the bay that have their little castles and fortresses and guns and what have you on them. Very picturesque. And for my purposes, very convenient, because there is now a ferry from Southampton to St. Malo, and there was in the 1890s. So Pitt can follow the fugitive in one fell swoop, well, two, one a train from London to Southampton and two a boat from Southampton across to St. Malo. He doesn't remain there indefinitely because he discovers that he's been thoroughly set up and lured away, and he will race back to London. In the meantime, Narroway has been potentially ruined by somebody raking up an old case which looks as if he did something very ugly. He's thrown out of his job, and Charlotte wants to rescue him. And they get in the opposite direction. They go to Dublin, which I think should be a lot of fun. I'm sure that I shall have to go to Dublin to do some research. I have a golden rule which applies even more to a standalone which I've got planned, set in the 1930s on the Amalfi Coast, Naples and Capri and things like that. And that's one that I will really have to research quite thoroughly. It would be, you wouldn't forgive me if I made a mistake, would you? I mean, I've got to know exactly what it's like, especially in the spring, perhaps, and, you know, in the late summer. I really think I need to know these things. I've already been twice, but that's not enough. So I expect, and I hope to end that one with a real bang, which I hope will be a surprise. And I've got another one beyond that contracted, but I haven't any ideas for that yet. I've got The Next Monk written and delivered a year or two ago, but it should be out this time next year. That's called Execution Doc. Now, normally with a thriller, you begin with a crime, and then you do the detection, you find out who it is, you chase them, you catch them, you try them, and then they're executed. This one starts with a trial. No, it starts with a chase, and then the trial, and then you have to prove that they were guilty, because they're found not guilty of the main crime. And then at the very end, you get the execution. It's all backside foremost and inside out. That would be fun to do it that way. Just try and do something really different. Set myself a major challenge. But the story is, there's one thread of it that's unfinished at the end, even after the execution. Execution Dock in London is a place, obviously, on the river, where they used to have a sort of iron cage that... At low tide was well above the water, but at high tide was well below it. And pirates used to be put in it, and the tide would come and go over them three times, by which time they were very, very dead, three times over. And somebody winds up in the cage, and it couldn't happen to a more deserving person. But there is a thread left over, and I want to explore this particular thread in The Next Monk, which is the next one I'm going to do, after I finish the Christmas story for not this year, but next year. And I want to explore in that family loyalties, because I think most of us have at least one person in our family that we really love very much and feel is particularly, especially close to us, has maybe looked after us all our lives, been there for us, we've known them forever. What happens if somebody like that is accused of something absolutely horrible that couldn't be a mistake, that couldn't have been a moment's panic or terror or jammed into a position you feel you can't get out of? What are you going to do? Do you even believe that they could be guilty? You've only ever known the good side of them. It's one thing to say, I will be loyal to my family, the people I love, no matter what. But if you do that and they are guilty, then what have you got left? What have you done to yourself? And what have you done if you desert them and perhaps they were innocent? Or even if they weren't innocent, do you desert people you love? Do you love them only because they're right? Do you love them only because they do the things you approve of or agree with you? I think it's a hideous position. It's never happened to me, and I don't know how I would behave. It's quite easy to say, oh, well, I will do the right thing, but the cost sometimes can be so intense. I don't know. I mean, if anybody attacked my father, I would leap in to defend him and think about it afterwards. And I think many of us are like that. So I'm going to really put some of the characters totally through the mangle, and it's going to destroy some relationships, not Monk and Hester, but other relationships are going to be tested to the point where they won't be the same again. And I think when you get deep wounds like that, sometimes it takes a long time to heal, if it does at all. But I'll rescue everybody, to at least to some extent, eventually, but not in that book, maybe in the one after. Well, you know, I think one of the measures of good writing is that you are prepared to do the painful and unpleasant things. I wouldn't let any of my main characters, like Thomas or Charlotte or Monk or Hester, get killed, and I wouldn't separate those couples. But I don't mind giving them some pain along the road, because very often it's only when you're tested that you grow. Don't we learn far more from the things that hurt us than we do from the things that go smooth sailing? I'm afraid that seems to be the case. So I've got quite a lot of things planned. The one after that I have not got planned yet. I don't really know what I'm going to do with it. I've got some ideas, because I like to plan well ahead, because for me, the most important thing, the beginning point of any story is, what do I want to say? What do I want to explore passionately enough that would keep me going at it for however long it takes? I mean, obviously I have got delivery dates, so it better not take too long. But what's going to get me up in the morning excited every day, apart from Sundays when I don't work Sundays, unless I'm on the road, of course. But it's got to be something I want to say, something I care about and feel so intensely, such as with the Pitt story on the qualities of leadership. What makes a good leader? Some difficult issues, I think. Sometimes it requires a loyalty to whatever it is you're doing, greater than that to the people you may know personally. You have to sacrifice something of your own comfort to be a good leader. It's not easy. How many times have we seen a leader remain loyal, and I'm thinking about our own political situation, remain loyal to somebody who's helped you on the path up, but whose behavior has become unacceptable? It's very hard to say, I'm sorry, I know I owe you, but I can't let you do this. You must go. Because my first loyalty is to the country, or to the service, or whatever it might be. It's a lonely position, and Pitt's not really cut out for it. So he's going to have a little bit of self-exploring to do when he has to take over from Narrowway for a brief while, and be quite glad to give it back. And those of you who've already read some Monk stories know that people's skills are not his great thing either, to put it mildly. But family loyalties, leadership qualities, and the cost of both or either are things I'd like to explore. And I want to do a standalone story. The one for which I have to go to the Amalfi Coast will be set in 1933. That's not contracted yet, but my editor has spoken to me about it. Starting in 1933 and finishing about 37, 38, and explore the rise of fascism in Europe, which is pretty dark and pretty frightening sort of subject. And I've chosen Naples to set it because I don't know how many of you here have been to Naples. One or two, yes. It's a beautiful city. But it doesn't matter whereabouts in the city you go, you can pretty well see Vesuvius from any point. it sort of looms there on the skyline all the time. And you can't forget that that is one of the most dangerous volcanoes in the world, because it doesn't sort of rumble and groan and complain every so often like Etna or Stromboli or many of the others. It waits and waits and waits, and when it goes, it really goes, as those in Pompeii and Herculaneum could tell you were they alive to do so. So if you live in Naples, you really feel one of two things very much. Either eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we might die. I know it's actually tomorrow we die, but you might. Or today I'd better be who I really want to be, because there might not be a tomorrow. And I think that all of us should consider trying very hard to decide who you want to be. Who do I want to be? What values do I really believe? If this is going to be the last day of my life, what are the things I want to say, want to do, want not to say or do? Who are the people I want to value and make sure I have peace with, and that I've said the brave or the generous things and not the grubby, silly things? Because one day there isn't going to be a tomorrow, which is a grim thought, but there is a today. And I want to have characters who learn to use their today and who can see both the possibility, because there was an eruption of Vesuvius in 33, who can see the possibility of that sleeping mountain blasting to pieces, but also see the possibility of Europe blasting itself to pieces, which tragically it did in World War II, as we all know. So, and I want to bring back, at least it's my plan at this point, to bring back Sam Weatherall from the war stories, because he is a man without a home and without a country, and he could do some brave and wonderful things there. And having survived World War I, he will know a lot of what war costs, and a lot of the pain of going through something so appalling you don't know if you can survive it. And as often happens when there has been a war, people very much want to forget it. The minute's over, they don't want to be reminded of what it cost. They don't want to see the wounded and the crippled, the shell-shocked, the bereaved. They want to forget it and just put it behind them. Hence we get the Jazz Age in the 20s and all those sort of things that were pretty hectic, because people knew what the horror had been. And for some reason or another, they didn't seem to see it ahead. Some did, but very few. So those are the plans for the future. Now I'd like to take questions, if I may, because I'd sooner be sure that I'm talking about something at least somebody's interested in, particularly.
Folks, the way this will work, if you haven't been here before, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. And who would like to start us off? Right here in the third row. Why don't I give you my mic?
Hi. Really nice for you to be here.
It's my pleasure.
Who is your favorite character of your books? And who is your favorite woman author other than yourself?
Oh, certainly not myself. It's very difficult to have a favorite. In some ways, if I have to pick one, because she's been around for a while, it'd be great Aunt Vespasia. She should have wish fulfillment. She's who I would like to be. But maybe the one I most admire is Joseph in the war stories. I admire Hester, and I'm fond of various others, but great Aunt Vespasia's wish fulfillment. Who is my favorite woman author? Got to be a woman, has it? Well, if it doesn't have to be a woman, I say probably Michael Connelly. I really do enjoy reading present-day American men. I want to get as far away from what I do as possible, which is sort of reasonably understandable, isn't it? Also, he sets most of his stories in Los Angeles, and I lived there for several years, so it's kind of familiar territory and has a good... He has such compassion. But I enjoy lots of different people. On the train journey here. I came on the train, didn't I? From Washington, D.C. today. I finished a book by Tess Gerritsen. I'd not read anything from hers before, and I enjoyed that. But Connolly has such compassion.
Another question.
Thank you for the question.
Hi. My question is on your research. Everything
yes.
is so detailed in your books. I mean, did you go to college, study history, English history?
No. I'm not really a historian. I'm a teller of stories. I do try to be as exact as possible. I want you to feel and taste and smell and hear as if you're there. I want not to make mistakes. I've done something brilliantly clever. I've got a younger brother who's a doctor. And he lived in Africa 23 years in Zimbabwe. And it's not a place to be anymore. And he returned with his family. Particularly for them, it wasn't a place to be. And when he first came back, he was going to continue in medicine. But my researcher fell ill and wasn't going to recover well enough to take up work again. And so Jonathan came and sort of manned the barricades for a little while. And then my mother said to me, you know, I think he'd like to do this permanently. I'd be, don't be silly. He's a doctor. He doesn't want to work for his sister. But she said, I think he does. I think he's sort of had enough of being called out in the small hours to disasters. He'd like to put a little more time to his family and his children. And I think he would. Yeah. But he did. And if you write mysteries and war stories, to have a brother who's a doctor, who's actually run his own MASH unit in war, who knows soldiers personally, you know, through wartime experience, who's done a spot of forensic work for the police, and whose sport happens to be target shooting, you've got a pretty good thing there. Especially since he's a pretty good student. He's quite keen on reading up stuff and studying. And I have just finished as far as sending it to the editor is concerned anyway. I mean, there will be rewrites because there always are. A standalone book set in Constantinople in the 1200s. And boy, if you think we didn't do research for that. He enjoys it. He finds it interesting. So if it's a fact, then he will just find the fact for me, such as if I've got my character in 1894 wants to take a train ride from London to Gloucester. Which mainline railway station do they go from? How much is it going to cost? How long will it take? What will the route be? Is the train one with corridors or not? And do they have to get out of the station if they want to go to the loo? And all this sort of thing. Then he just finds the facts for me. But there are other things where you want the flavour and the belief of something. And he'll put, you know, these sticky things, post-its that don't damage a book, and say, right, read from there to there.
Another question.
And, of course, I do have to read whole books from time to time.
Hi. I'd like to ask you about the clothes, the gowns that you describe so beautifully.
Yes.
Do you see them? Have you seen them? Because
I get fashion books from the period. And it has to be the right year and the right season, because colours came and went according to, you know, the season, and one year it would be bigger sleeves, and the next year it would be embroidery in different places, and a colour was in or was out, just like now.
Oh, I always enjoy your descriptions of the clothes.
I love clothes, don't you?
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, you know, what would we be without them? It would be, if we just all had... I had a schoolmistress once who said, I wish we all just wore uniforms. I was struck speechless. That's like saying, I wish we had bread and water for every meal. Take all the fun out of life.
Back here on our left.
How did you happen to choose to write the kind of novel that you write and in the era that you set it in? And is there any connection with your own life experience?
No. I used to write straight historical stories and was unable to get them published. And the first mystery I wrote, I was not interested in who did whatever, but how families, or even non-families, how they respond to each other under the pressure of investigation, and you realize how little you really know the people that you thought you knew very well. And that was what I wanted to explore, which I did in the first mystery I wrote, and that was the first book that was accepted. And I set it in the Victorian era because I started to think along those lines when my stepfather came up with an idea as to who Jack the Ripper might have been. And we do know, but I don't really want to. He's much better as a monster, as sort of anonymous. But I began to think, well, what about, how would people feel if they thought, well, I passed by that corner. I might have seen one of those women. I might have seen him without realizing it. It could be somebody I know. It could be somebody I know quite well. And, oh, God, it could be somebody in my family. And then you begin to look at everybody differently and realize that you don't actually know people nearly as well as you think. And when the police come and start to question you, do you really tell the truth if it's embarrassing or silly? I mean, it may not be anything criminal. It may just be that you feel an idiot. Maybe you're in love with somebody who doesn't feel that way about you, and the last thing you want is for them to know that. But would your little lie perhaps incriminate somebody else? You discover things about yourself and about other people that, to me, are the basis of the real guts of a story. And that book sold, so obviously I'd made the next one as much like it as possible. And since that Jack the Ripper was 1888, I said it in the 1880s in London. It sort of seemed the obvious thing to do. And it's a good period to write mysteries if you don't want to do the forensic detail, because your detection is going to be based upon observation and understanding of human nature, which we all have. Therefore, it is a novel, not a police procedural in the modern sense. But when that one sold, and then they took an option on the next one, and then took that one an option on the one after, and so on, until they had 10 altogether, then I changed publishers, and they actually commissioned me to write one, too. And I knew I was going to eat for the rest of the year. So that's why I write mysteries. And then when they commission a mystery, that's what you write. I mean, some people seem to have the idea you write whatever you want, and the publisher's going to take it. Just try it sometime and see how far you get. I mean, they know the market. They know what your reputation is. You write what you're asked to write. I have never been asked to deal with subjects I didn't want to, or to make things more graphic than they are. But my contract is to write 2 more Pits and 2 more Monks. They can be whatever I want them to be, but they must be Pits and Monks. I can set them where I want. I can make the storyline what I want. I can have whatever characters I want. But they must be within that general area. So that's what I do. And they will take the standalones if we talk about it, and I give them a really good outline. But, I mean, they're in business, and business is tough. They're not going to just let you do anything. It won't work. So I write them as a sort of matter of evolving from that being the first thing they took to now, that's what I do. The war stories were completely different, but I gave them 100 pages of outline before they took them, which is reasonable. You can't expect them to contract 5 books without knowing what they're going to be.
Back here on, all right.
I realized today, when I knew I was coming to see you and was trying to choose some favorite books, Calendar Square was the first book of yours that I ever read, which I think I must have read when I was about 2.
Oh, please.
And you probably wrote when you were maybe 9 or 10, because it, nearly 30 years really frightens me. But I just wanted to say I've loved your books since that period, but I think the war books were absolutely extraordinary. I've enjoyed everything you've written, but they were so lovely. And I understand Joseph was inspired to a degree by your own grandfather,
yes,
who was a
chaplain. His name was Joseph Reveley, who was a chaplain in the trenches in World War I. And thank you very much for that, because they're very close to my heart. I care about them very, very much. And I was just today speaking to a gentleman who's written film script for all 5.
Wonderful.
And it's looking hopeful. But you're never there until you're there. But I cared about those intensely. And I gave the outline of all 5 with 100 pages of, 100 pages of outline, scene by scene, to my editor who bought them, my publisher. And I cared. It took me 7 years from the beginning of the outline until the end of the last one. But I still care about them just as much as I did at the beginning, if not more. So I really appreciate the fact that you got something from them too.
Glad to hear we're going to find out a little bit more about Sam. Might he possibly know what some of the Reevleys have been up to?
Oh, wonderful. Yes. He will have kept in touch.
Right here, the 5th row.
I just wanted to ask you, will Vespasia get into Buckingham Palace?
Oh, she's been in lots of times.
No, I mean in this book, the new book.
The next one?
The one you have just written, and it's upstairs. Where Pitt is doing.
No, Vespasia is not in this very much. She has a very, very brief encounter with. I think she speaks to Pitt very briefly. It's so long since I wrote it. Years.
But she's not going to get dressed up and go to the palace.
No.
Okay.
She is going to get dressed up and go to Osborne in the next one I do, the next Pitt, to visit Victoria at Osborne.
Just keep gobbling up your books.
Thank you.
Another question. Gentleman back here on our left.
It's kind of a two-part question. Have you ever served on a jury in a criminal case?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I guess that answers my second question, because I think, do you bring all that you've learned and all that you've studied to that, or do you just put it aside?
I think that they would probably disqualify me. I don't know. But I live in an area that has been continuous. My village has been continuously occupied by somebody or another for the last 4,000 years. But we don't have a very high crime rate, because only about 400 people. I do believe some kids stole some cigarettes from the golf club. But that's about, you know, we get the odd drunk and disorderly. But, you know, those aren't usually jury cases. I do know somebody who served on the jury, but it was an accidental death. And they were prosecuted for dangerous driving. But we're very sparsely populated. It's not that we're all that much more virtuous than everybody, but, you know, on the average crime rate, you know, our turn's going to come around every 100 years or so. So it's pretty unlikely that I would be called. Probably call me when I'm over here. And I would say, I can't do that. I would hate to be on a jury, actually.
All the way back here.
Hi. I love the Inspector Monk series.
Thank you.
And I love the characters, Hester and Oliver. And I'm wondering when the next one's going to come out, because I'm so desperate to read another one.
Thank you very much. I think probably about this time next year. I handed it in a year ago or more. But, you know, they'll publish it when they're ready. As we all know, the climate is a little bit more uncertain at the moment than it has been.
Can you tell me if he's still going to be an inspector, or is he going to be in business for himself?
A monk?
Is he?
No,
yes.
He's going to stay in the River Police for quite a while.
He's going to stay there, okay.
Because I have to test him on his leadership and his people skills, and added to which there's so much interesting that goes on the river. This is the execution dock one that's coming.
Okay, great.
It's supposed to be sort of the longest street in London, the river is, and there's so much that goes on, and there are so many buildings of intense importance that are by the side of the river, right from Kew Gardens to, you know, the Chelsea Embankment, to Buckingham Palace, to the Lambeth Palace, with the Archbishop of Canterbury's home, and the Houses of Parliament, and the Royal Observatory, and the London Docks, and the slums, and Limehouse, and goodness knows what. I can have a lot more fun with that yet.
Folks, why don't we end up right here in the second row?
Hi.
Hello.
When you're creating a character, what techniques as a writer do you use to, like, flesh them out and develop them and make them sort of believable?
I start with a name and a face. If I've got a face in my mind, not a made-up face, it'll be something like a real face, and I might change it a little bit. But if I know what they look like, I think you can tell a lot about a person from their face. And it may sound ridiculous, but having the right name really matters. Sometimes I will have written a character quite a lot and thought, this person's not alive. And if I go back and change their name, sometimes they come off the page for me, and I know them better and can make them say and do things that matter. But the more you do with any one character, the more you have defined them, and you can no longer do anything with them. You have to do something that fits in with who they already are. And you can't say they're a bit short-tempered and scared of spiders on page 10, and then on page 20 you make them pick up spiders and, you know, be all sweet-tempered. Whatever you say about them limits what else you can say, unless you give them a reason to change. But let's say they're phobic about spiders. I pick that because I'm not fond of them myself. Then, if they have a spider between them and where they need to be, they need to have courage to get past it. What is it that's going to be enough? I mean, I'm making it up as I go along. What is it that's going to be enough to make them actually get past that spider? For me, it's somebody else that's even more scared of it than I am. Every time you make them do something, you're saying more about them. And I think that if your important characters in a story don't actually make a journey during that story, don't discover something about themselves and change, then the story wasn't worth writing. So what is that person's journey? Is it up or down? Are they better or worse? What have they learned about themselves, about others? What have they conquered, or what has conquered them? And why? There's always got to be a really sensible why, and it shouldn't be too obvious. Not that their mother dropped them on their head, or that they saw this or that. Because it must be complex, because people are very complex. But just liking people, being interested, And the other side to it is the journey of self-discovery. You want a character to do something other, you think, well, what would I do in that situation? What might I do? And you learn things about yourself. I have a little exercise which is only for major characters. But if you were to stand at the edge of the world, and this right there is the abyss, and I really mean the abyss, I mean the one from which you don't come back, and you're facing Satan, and there's nobody but you and he there, and he says, what do you really believe? And you know that if your answer is dishonest, you're going straight over there and you're not coming back. What do you believe? It's quite a difficult thing to think what you really believe. So much that it's not somebody, it's not what your priest or your rabbi told you, it's not what your parents told you, it's not what you think you ought to believe, or your best friend or your peer group or whatever. What do you really believe that you live or die for and there's nobody else listening but Satan? You discover that much about yourself. And it could be about any particular issue, but you go right into yourself and then you put that into your characters. But I mean, you don't do that for the postman who walks on and delivers a letter and walks off. You do it for the people who make a spiritual journey within your story. Who are they really when the chips are down? Then you put them in a situation that's absolutely rotten and see what they do. Or you don't see that they will do something without your guidance. Of course, you think carefully, what would they do? Some people say, you know, you think your characters and they write the book for you. Nobody's ever written a book for me that way. And I don't think it works. I think you have to work at your characters and decide exactly what they're going to do and why. You have to know them pretty well. One of the most useful exercises I ever did, I did at great reluctance, because I had a fantasy story in which, I didn't call him Satan, I called him Asmodeus, but he was the devil in a sense, had quite a strong part to play in it. And my London agent said to me, write out the whole plot from his point of view, you know, half a dozen pages. I said, why don't you just do it? So I did. It was one of the most useful things I have ever done. Take your villain, your antagonist, whoever it is who is the chief opposition to your protagonist, and write the story out from his or her point of view. Because your protagonist is only going to jump as high as the antagonist makes them. I mean, nobody leaps 10 feet over a 2-foot wall. Look at that person and make them real. Because if they're just cardboard, the story doesn't ever take off. Make them real. Give them a point of view so that they seem, at least to themselves, to be justified. Let us know how they see the protagonist and why they do what they do. Then you've got the beginnings of a really good story. Does that answer the question?
I know I said that was the last one, but let's take another.
Thank you. What time of day do you write? How long do you write in a day? And where do you write?
I write in my study, which has windows on three sides. To the south, it looks over the courtyard. To the west, it looks right up into the middle of Scotland, mountains after mountains. And to the north, it looks across the inlet, the Firth, we call it, which is like a fjord, to the mountains of Sutherland. I mean, Telia Sutherland. And my garden. And I normally start at about 8:30 in the morning, and I stop at about 1 and have lunch. Sometimes I take a walk, back to work at 2. I go through to 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever. Sometimes I go back after dinner in the evening, sometimes I don't. And I work Mondays through Saturdays. And I write with a pen on paper.
And that's why we have
so enjoy writing.
I was just going to say, and that's why you've got so much great stuff to read from Anne. Please join me in thanking Anne Perry.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.